says he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is also head of the body, the church, and he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. So there are three main things we've seen so far in this letter. Number one, we need to know God. Number two, that means we need to know the Son of God. And number three, the justification for that statement is he is the image of God. I wonder how important you think that is for your life. Is that how you've been thinking this week? You've been thinking that that's the source of all my problems. I don't know who God is. Right in the middle of that argument that was happening, is that what you were thinking? The reason this is happening is
that I don't know. We'll go without it.
The reason this is happening is I don't know who God is. When you were worried, were you thinking that? That the reason I'm worried is I don't know who he is, or even more particularly, if I could only know the Son of God, then I could really live. Or even more particularly than that, right? Because he's not just said I need to know God, but he said the way to do that is know the Son of God. And he's not even said I need to know the Son of God, but the way to do that is I need to know that he's the image of God. So is that what you've been thinking? If I can only know that Christ is the image of God, then could I live life right. Is that what any of you have been thinking this week? Of course it's not. 2 Corinthians 4:4. The God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving so that they might not see the light of the gospel, which is the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. What does it look like to be under the influence of Satan? Paul will tell you what it looks like. It looks like passing the whole week without ever even thinking Christ is the image of God. It does not look like crawling backwards and a video being taken of some Catholic priest. It looks like going to the ball game, going to the grocery store, going to school, even coming to church,
with the thought not in your mind, and on your heart, and faith something to it, that Christ is the image of God. Satan knows this is important. He knows there is one truth about God, which if he can keep you blinded from, you will never fall. If you're here today and you're an unbeliever, there's one reason. It's not any kind of abuse. It's not any kind of victimization from any other sinner. Because if you could see that Christ is the image of God, you would follow him even though you've been abused. It's not because of a sickness. It's not because of cancer. There's only one reason. If you are here today and you're an unbeliever, you do not see with the eyes of your heart that Jesus is the image of God. And that is the reason, and that is the only reason you're an unbeliever, if you are. Which is also the reason and the only reason any believer struggles in their faith, according to Paul. Paul knows how important this is, not only Satan, and he was commissioned to turn us Gentiles from darkness to light, from the kingdom of Satan to God, that those who are blind may see. And the thing that we are determined to see is this. So Paul has told us in this letter, there is one truth. I mean, this is something. This has been something to me this week. There is one North Star that if I could just see it, and it could be on my heart, if my heart could feel it and I could see it, then I would live the Christian life and change that is.
Never got used to from the Lawrence Hale and calling him Peyton. Still hope. Anything's possible. I'm not seeing it though. So, Satan knows this is important, and this is the one thing that he tries to blind me from seeing. He doesn't try to blind me from seeing how many omega-3s I need. He tries to blind me from seeing that Christ is the image of God. And the apostle, to me, which is a Gentile, is telling me that if I could know God, then I would live the Christian life. That means to know the Son of God. That means to know that He's the image of God. If I knew that, apart from every other thing that I know or don't know, that would be a North Star. And I would be bearing fruit in every good work. And I would be being strengthened with all steadfastness and patience. And I would be a thankful person. Make no mistake about it. The claim, the proposition that Paul believes and Satan believes is that you will live the Christian life if and only if you know that Christ is the image of God. If you see that he's the image of God, you live the Christian life. If you don't see that he's the image of God, you don't live the Christian life. So, my life depends. I am not playing something this morning. I am preaching to you about the truth that I believe my life depends on. And your life depends on. If you don't see this singular truth, you will never live the Christian life, and you will never avoid perishing. So Paul thinks it's important and the source of everything. Satan thinks it's important and the source of everything. The only question is, what do you and I think? And even if you don't know what the image of God, Christ being the image of God means, surely you have to think, apparently I need to. And so now the question becomes, what does it mean to say that Christ is the image of God? And once you ask yourself that question, maybe you say to yourself, well, I suppose I need to know what the image of God even is first, right? Otherwise, how could I know that he fulfills it unless I know the glove that he fills? And so you think, okay, I need to know what the image of God is. And then you start thinking down that road and you think, well, I guess that takes me back to Genesis 1, right? Surely Paul didn't write this without thinking of that. And so I guess I need to know what it means to say that man is the image of God. And if you thought that way, I would say you're right. So to Genesis 1 we go. The focus of Genesis 1 is masterful in the way that it works. Start reading it with me. You first see in the beginning God. It begins with in the beginning God. And so maybe you think, well, this is a book about theology, first off. But then it moves to cosmology and geology, because then it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. So then maybe you think, well, maybe it's a book about one of these two things. It's going to be focused on cosmology or geology. But then it narrows down to geology, because it then goes on to focus on the earth. The earth was formless and void and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters, and God starts to create and beautify and organize, and now the heavens are left behind, and the earth is the stage for whatever else I'm about read. And so you think definitely the focus is on the earth. And when you read the 6 days, you sort of see, you might say that the macro things are created first. Perhaps you might think of it as fire and then air and then earth and water, kind of the basic land, water, light, atmosphere. And that's sort of the canvas is set, and then now it is animals with biology, plant and animal life, and the land, the sea, and the air. And so maybe you might think, well, this is a lot about that. Maybe it's about biology. Maybe that's the focus of this book that I'm beginning to read. But then the whole thing climaxes from verse 26 to 31 with anthropology and man is the focus. So it starts with theology, it's from God, okay, geology, biology, it goes all the way down to the focus is put upon man. Just think of this. Instead, in verse 26, notice the contrast. Instead of let there be light and this and that, instead of let the earth bring forth this and that and the other, just let us make. Very different in the red. Instead of fruit according to its kind, and this animal according to its kind, is let us make man in our image, according to our kind. Very good. Instead of it was good, and it was good, and it was good, it was very good. You even notice that stars are oriented toward Earth the way they are for the sake of man. Verse 14, then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for times and seasons and days and years. The James Webb Telescope, right? If we could just see the quasar and nebula and look at these images, the Bible would say, look at your wife! Look at your husband! Look at the old person in the nursing lounge! At this thing before you. It's all in relation to man. Even the definition of what is good is in relation to man. This is good, and this is good, and this is good. All in relation to what is good for man. So, Genesis chapter 1 says there's man and everything else. There's only two categories. There's anthropology and non-anthropology in the biblical worldview. Man is special. Man is sui generis. He's in a class by himself. He's the focus of everything. He's the protagonist in the story. Every other character is oriented toward him, including Satan. So, you ask yourself why that is. There's only one clue given in the text. Because he's the enemy of God. That's why he's the focus. That's why the stars are oriented toward him. I hope. What would it do? Think of the difference. Stephen Hawking. We're just a random planet on the outskirts of a random, insignificant galaxy that happened to evolve with no intent, no special origin, no meaning, no final justice, no ultimate purpose. And then alternatively you have, you're such the center of the story, the stars are turned in towards you like lights onto a stage. I wonder if people have different mental health with that worldview. versus the other. So the only clue that's given to why this is the case is that man is made in the image of God. Now I want you to think about this in light of what we've been saying. See, the heavens are telling the glory of God. That does image God. And his wisdom is over his work. So everything reveals God. But yet, apparently, it makes sense to call man the image. So, as there's a holy place, and then there's the holy of holies, there are images, and then there are images. That means there is some kind of very special way that man, and man alone, images. And it is what separates him from all other things and beings. And it's the reason for all the focus on him. And it is the singular ground for the wonder of being a human. What is it? Some preliminary thoughts. The first thing we could say is whatever it is, it is the basis of our dignity. Look at Genesis 9, in verse 6. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. This is the doctrine underneath why it is wrong to kill a man, but not necessarily wrong to kill a mosquito. He is made in the image of God. That means when someone strikes a human being, they are manifesting a behavior and a heart attitude that if they were able would strike the Creator himself. Such that John says, you can't hate your brother whom you do see, and love God whom you do not see. It's not possible that you love my child and you just slash up pictures of my child. It's not possible. So whatever it means, this is what gives us dignity. I mean, this is the basis of the murder commandment. This is the basis of all human civilization. You can't even get so... We got to at least agree to not murder each other to get us a sign of going. This is the basis of it. If this isn't there, there's no reason that I can't tinker with you and play with your genes. And do things, see, there's no doctrine underneath that. Why should I not? Why should I not say Christ? So, whatever it is, the basis of our dignity. Second, it is not something that is in man. As though there's a part of man that is the image and a part of man that is a non-image. It's not said that it's something in you. From top to bottom. All that you are is image. That is something. The whole of you is the image. Third is even after the fall, it is not lost. Look at James chapter 3. James 3. Verse 9, with it we bless, with it, the tongue, we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who've been made in the likeness of God. These things all about people. So obviously it wasn't lost in false. And then yet, the fourth preliminary thought is, apparently something was lost. Apparently an ethical component and a epistemological mental and, you know, a moral and a mental component was obviously lost, because look at what Paul says in Ephesians 4, verse 24. That you be renewed in your spirit of your mind and put on the new man, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. And then similarly, Colossians 3, verse 10, and have put on the new man, who is being renewed to a true knowledge according to the image of the one who created him. Fifth preliminary thought. It must be huge, then. Whatever it is huge, because if you're trained in a good Christian worldview at all, you know that the basic four pillars are creation, fall, redemption, consummation. The image of God being shows up in all four. Not only in Genesis that man was created in the image of God. Not only can you see from Colossians and Ephesians here that in some sense it was fallen and it is being restored, but look at Romans 8. Romans 8 in verse 29. Paul says, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his Son. It does not mean simply sanctification. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 49. In the midst of a discussion of the resurrection, he says this, just as we have borne the image of the earthy, we will, my grammar students notice that, we will also bear the image of the heavenly. So part of bearing the redemptive image of God includes the resurrection. Includes the body. So that we can say the whole storyline of the Bible, the whole theme is the image of God. And you might say, well, I thought the theme was the glory of God. Look at 1 Corinthians 11, verse 7. Paul says, man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God. The Bible is not a story about an abstract glory, but a concrete glory. If I told you a story about red apples, it's not a story about redness in the abstract. It's a story about a red apple. And the Bible is not a story about glory in the abstract. It's a story about a concrete glory in man. The focus can be God's glory and man at the same time, if man is the glory. Somehow the glory is going to shine through man. So you could say this. The Christian worldview is about the creation of the image of God, the fall of the image of God, the redemption of the image of God, and the consummation of the image of God. The Bible is about the image of God. And the ironic thing about that, the thing the Bible is about, the one thing it's about, and the one thing that makes us unique is
something most people don't even understand. Most Christians don't even understand. How would you fare if we passed out a sheet of paper and said, write the definition of the image of God and turn it in? What would it say? And look, it's not even debatable. For years I have been shocked by this, and I felt like I must be wandering into heresy or something, because I feel like I was the only one seeing this. And I recently called Jeffrey Johnson on the phone to share some of my ideas. And he was like, I think you should write a book about this. Because there were some ideas that he had about the image of God that once I shared some of what I'm going to share with you today, he saw a win. But here's what I mean. If you pick up a systematic theology book, or you find some article on the image of God, do it. Do it. Test it. Be a Berean after you hear the sermon. Test it. And you look up, whoever you look up, boy, what does it mean to say man's the image of God? The whole history of interpretation is not even debatable. That they basically struggle to define it. Essentially, what you'll find is they know it must mean something. And they know it's the source of our dignity. They know that it was somewhat lost in the fall and somewhat not lost. That about sums it up. And they just kind of awkwardly move on. And that's about all you have. And that's tragic. It's the theme of the Bible. No wonder people are confused about covenants. It's like, and trying to figure out, well, how do I read Obadiah and this and that? We don't even know the theme of the story. And all I want to do in this sermon is explain what I think it's not. The negative. Come back to the positive next week. So here's one suggestion that has been made, that man's ability to reason is what the image of God is. This is the Greek conception. It's why many people refer to man as a homo sapien, man the wise. Of course the Greeks would do that, because they were trying to reason autonomously apart from the Creator, by man's reason alone, and figure everything out. And this is the reason, heads up, why those of us into classical Christian education need to be careful of the classical part, lest it spoil the Christian part. Because classical just means Greek and Roman. And the adage is still well spoken, beware of Greeks' various gifts. And so there's some of what an unbeliever can say that can be true because of common grace, and there are some things that an unbeliever can say that are false because of sin in an unbeliever. So you always have to sit and be very careful. But this is one thing that is mentioned, but this cannot be the very special, unique attribute that makes man and distinguishes him from all other beings as the image of God, for the simple reason that angels can reason. And for the simple reason that what do you do with people who are mentally handicapped? That do you then conclude that they are somehow less of the image of God? And what do you do with animals like the octopus and the elephant, who seem to be figuring some stuff out? I don't know what's going on in there, but it's different than an amoeba. And so, does it make sense to say that that is the image? And that's why the Reformers and other Christians combated the name, the noun, homo sapien, with homo adorans, man the worshiper. Two different worldviews on how you define man. Other than reason, some say that they put forth that it's self-awareness and consciousness. But what about when you're asleep? What about if you're brain dead and you're laying there on the hospital bed? Are you no longer the image of God? Better than that, what about when you are dead and we're left with your body? Should we bury you like Abraham did? Should we carry your bones somewhere like they did for Joseph? Should we burn you like pagan Achilles? Because after all, doesn't matter, right? Just a body. So, it doesn't make sense to say it is self-consciousness. Again, angels are self-conscious. They're not into God. Third, some will say it is man's ability to be ethical. And base that on the Ephesians 4, Colossians 3 text. Probably the most popular. But once again, angels are able to be ethical. So, righteousness or sin, and they sin. That can't be it. Then will come the idea, well, maybe it's man's ability to be relational and social and organically connected. You know, angels are like units. They don't have a father and mother. They're individual units. They're just created on the spot. They don't know what it's like to be organically related and have this kind of relationship and all of that. And that will be submitted, but polar bears do. And squirrels do. And all kind of animals do. They have male and female, and they grow out of each other. They're organically connected, and they're not. They're not the image of God. Some, and I've toyed with this for a while, say that it's man's ability to be male and female in some kind of imitation of the Trinity, but once again, it just breaks down because all other animals, a considerable amount of animals, have that binary organic ability. And then finally, some will say it is our bodies. You know, man images God because he has eyes, like I'm looking at you right now. Say that he who made the eyes, does he not also see? And so I image God that way. But doesn't the spider? When that thing would go find the creature that has the most eyes, and he triply, quadruply, you know, images God? There are creatures with eyes, and eyeballs are the image of God, and I don't think that they are. But a dog has them, and a cat has them. And so you can draw these inferences about your Creator from more than just man. It's not unique to him. Nor the ability to hear or use our arms. You know, the Lord is compared to having an arm, and we have an arm, and in this anthropomorphic language like this, we image God that way. I don't doubt that we do in that way. I just doubt that that is the image. Because octopus has arms. A monkey has arms. Some say, finally, it is our souls or our spirits. That one falls too, because angels are called ministering spirits. So if it's not the soul or the spirit, it's not the body per se, it's not our ability to be organic and relational and connected through childbirth, it's not our ability to be self-aware and conscious, it's not our ability to reason, it's not our morality and ethic, it's got to be something. And the positive answer we're going to do.